This week, the Rascals mince about Democrats versus Republicans, if you would take your family to the Grand Floridian, and would MJ let the Bulls collapse the same way Golden State did?
Today is Friday. It's June 17th, 2016. We are the Mincing Rascals. I'm John Williams. You can hear me Saturdays from 1 to 3 on WGN Radio.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of The Business Lunch on WGN.
And you always act like you didn't know that, it was...
I know. Well, I'm always doing other things.
Do you look at each other and go, whose turn is it next?
Well, you know what happens is...
Why the pregnant pause?
They look at me and say, Steve, and with their eyeballs.
Right. I'm urging him. Steve.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of The Business Lunch on WGN.
And I'm Krista McQuarrie, a member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board.
And a columnist as well, twice monthly. Is that right there,
That's
Kristen?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about one of your columns in just a minute. Your colleague at the Tribune, Eric Zorn, can't be with us today, which will make this a lot easier for the rest of us. I have to say that. Eric listens to the podcast. Let's talk about the Orlando shooting. I got a whole host of questions in front of me, guys, and if you don't mind, I'll just kind of go through my list of questions, curiosities, and conundrums. Should the media be using the shooter's name? Kristen, the Tribune continues to publish it, but I know one major NBC outlet in Minneapolis, Care 11, is not going to mention his name, they said, and maybe we shouldn't. What are your thoughts on that?
I feel like we have this conversation every time something like this happens. Is the other station not naming it because they don't want to elevate him or create like a copycat situation?
Right. I think the media is a little complicit in the culture that leads to these things. They're opting out.
I mean, it's hard for me to not side on the side of news. This was a huge story. He was killed on the scene. There's really no question that he's responsible for it. So I don't have a problem using his name at all.
No. What's your thought about that, Steve?
It's like during a rainstorm closing your upstairs window because the basement is flooded. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. I mean, you know, maybe they feel good about that. Maybe they're taking a stand of it. But whether or not, you know, he needs to be named. We need to know who he is. We need to know about him. I think that's sort of an empty effort.
Well, I think it would be if it were only that, but I think there's more to it than that. I feel that,
Do you think if the other shooters hadn't been named that this guy wouldn't have shot up that nightclub?
I think there's a certain momentum that these guys feed off of, and the more we exalt these people, however perversely in their minds, the more likely it is that somebody else will do that again. Malcolm Gladwell was on TV this week, and he said, I guarantee this guy was obsessed with Columbine, that these terrible people gain fame, and they live vicariously through that until they pull the trigger. For instance, I have been able to read some of his tweets and Facebook posts and some of his thoughts and feelings about ISIL or the United States, and I'm thinking, you want to talk irrelevant? I don't think we should even be sharing that. He doesn't have a relevant position in the dialogue about America and ISIS. So if he wants to call out something before he pulls the trigger, that's not germane. That's not germane.
So you're not calling this a terrorist attack at all?
No, I think it's a hate crime. Okay. I think it is. I mean, what do you think? I think that question matters, Steve. What's your answer to that?
I think it's all mixed together. I mean, I think the anti-American rhetoric and the ISIS movement probably helped allow him to do this, but clearly it was a hate crime too.
You got to be crazy first. You have to be a hate person. If there were no ISIS, if there were no Muslim faith, no Islam, do you think this would have happened, this crime?
I mean, I don't know, but the fact that he called on, you know, when he was committing the crime and he was on the phone identifying himself as an ISIS sympathizer, how can you not, you know, categorize this as, of course, it was a terrorist attack. And yes, it was a hate crime. And that's why it is not extra meaningful, but to the gay and lesbian community who already feel targeted. This was, and then to have some politicians not come out as strongly as they maybe would have if it was a different club, has been just made the story especially grinding and raw and terrible. And the news media cannot not cover it or tone down the coverage or try to take responsibility so that another copycat doesn't happen. I mean, 50 people lost their lives. It's very newsworthy and serious.
Yeah. Well, I hope I don't sound like I'm saying we shouldn't cover it or look at all of the issues, but I just want to talk a little bit more about whether or not this is a terrorist attack. To me, a terrorist attack means that ISIL directed it or that a foreign government helped him plan it. This is a lone wolf. This is just a hateful, deranged individual.
But I'm sorry to interrupt, John, but I by that definition, then San Bernardino wouldn't be a terror attack, right?
I don't know that it was. I mean, it reminds me of San Bernardino.
So it was a workplace shooting. I mean, it was his workplace.
Sure. For instance, as a result of this, should we stop the inflow of immigrants from those parts of the world, whatever those are? No, of course not. I don't see the connection. Kristen.
I think lone wolf terrorism is the world we live in now. If someone is willing to, it's no different than maybe a suicide bomber attacking our troops overseas. If someone is willing to kill others and then kill him or herself, that's terrorism. I mean, and why are we so uncomfortable using the word? I don't understand the semantic debate that happens every time this occurs.
Well, because it happened this time, too.
In this case, if it's terrorism, it's ISIS-related, which is part of a bigger fight than
whether
it's anti-gay. Right?
Steve, you watched President Obama this week struggle at first to not say radical Islam, and then called out by Donald Trump, he at least explained himself. What did you think of his rationale behind all of that?
Well, if it's true that foreign governments, Islamic governments, have asked him not to use that term, then I certainly understand why he wouldn't. To me, this strikes me as a fight in a marriage where you decided 10 years ago to do something or not do something, and now you just can't change it, you know, because this is, we've always said it this way or we've never said it this way, and I'm not going to let you make me use this term, right? I mean, that's kind of where they are with Obama and Islamic terror.
What do you think, Kristen?
I mean, I've heard some Islamic groups here in Chicago who, you know, they're kind of the go-to people after something like this happens. They call it radical Islam, too. And they are very clear in clarifying that this is not symbolic of the religion overall, that this is not instructed from the Quran. But I don't think they hesitate to admit that these are folks who have been radicalized through Islam. So I just don't understand why we're so sensitive about using that term.
I also don't understand why we're so outraged that it's not used. I mean, I think both sides have made too much of this.
Semantics.
Well, I think that's the president's doing. He's the one that's elevated this conversation to something really severe. And if he had been saying radical Islam all along, I think we would have shrugged. But now it's a very, you know, sort of divisive two words. You're either with him or against him on that rhetoric.
But who cares?
Right.
How irrelevant whether he says it or not. And so to carry out this campaign where, you know, he obviously doesn't understand the enemy because he won't say, fill in your blank, is ridiculous, too. None of it matters. And we should just move beyond it.
Do you think that John McCain was right? He walked this back a little bit, but he said that President Obama is responsible for an attack like what happened in
directly.
And then later he said, I don't mean personally, I mean his policies. I don't know that that's a distinction that the president necessarily appreciates. But what do you guys think about that? Remember, the void is filled because President Obama didn't continue to commit troops there. ISIL flourishes, and then some knucklehead in Florida feeds off of that. So there's the connection. Are the president's policies responsible for this, Kristen?
No, and that's not a partisan answer. I would not single out the president of the United States to be singularly and directly responsible if he or she were a Republican either. I don't like all the blame back and forth, trying to lay all of this at his feet when you have a global crisis with ISIS attacking all over the world and just radicalized groups. To lay that at the feet of one person is just rhetorical hyperbole.
He has arguments that the policy was a bad policy, the Obama administration's policy, and that, you know, it might have fed into ISIS. Those are all very legitimate arguments. But he used the term, the word directly, and he used it over and over. He is directly responsible. And when they went back to him the second time, he said, yes, directly responsible. First of all, he must not understand what directly responsible is, right? Because it would be indirectly. And now Donald Trump is using John McCain's words on the campaign trail for himself. So it's sort of poetic justice there. I thought I think he could make a good argument for what he was trying to say.
Yeah,
but I think
sure.
he sounded like a bitter man who's been around too long, and that's too bad.
Well, I mean, let's examine what he may have been trying to say, or at least that which we can all agree on, and that is our policy has not vanquished ISIL in the last 5 years, has it? I mean, do we have to own a little bit of that?
Well, yes, I suppose we do. I'm not sure we really understand what drives ISIL. And if you read, there was a great Atlantic piece maybe 2 years ago that sort of got into the reasons why ISIL, you know, is quote unquote successful. I don't know that they're paying all that close of attention to American policies. It has more to do with power, wealth, oil, money, Middle Eastern politics than it does here. So I don't know that, you know, policies that come out of the White House or Congress are attributable to some guy walking in with body armor and shooting 50 people at a nightclub or any of the lone wolf examples that we've talked about.
Well, I'm wondering, too, what we should do about all of this anyway. That is, should we ask the Congress to enact policies that will restrict the purchases of guns, go after the munitions, or should we ask Congress to go after the people, no fly, no buy policies or something like that? Should we make it harder for mentally ill people or people on no fly lists to get guns?
So far, they're all yeses. What are your other questions?
Well, I don't know which is easier, to be honest with you, Steve. I think the no fly, no buy thing is not as easy as it sounds. Hillary Clinton is, you know, indignant. Of course we have to do that. And I'm thinking, okay, exactly how do you do that? Because people are on the no-fly list who shouldn't be. Bugs Bunny's on that list.
But there is a way to get off the no-fly list, right? There is an appeal process
there. I think that's the process that you cannot. There is no appeal process. There is an appeal process for one of the other lists, but the no-fly list, there is no way
really,
to
I
get
thought
off.
Really, I thought if you went and you could say, wait a minute, you've got me confused, or...
I'll do a search while we're sitting here, but I just listened to it.
But how long are you on that list? When do you get off that list? And it's a Second Amendment right. And if the government, this is the slippery slope, Steve, if the government says, you know, we just don't like Bertrand, the spelling of his name or the chat rooms he's been in, he's on the no-fly list. Well, some of us would say good, but really? So now
that.
He can't go in and buy a gun?
No, I get that. But they are able to say, I can't fly in an airplane. Yeah. I mean, they are able to take that.
But that's not a constitutionally protected right. You don't have the right to fly an airplane. I mean, and if you do, Steve, please, at least it's on a different level.
I don't know. I think
than one of the first 10 amendments to the Constitution.
I don't agree with you there. I think if the government can say unequivocally, we think this guy might be dangerous enough to where we won't even let him get on an airplane, that they should be able to say he's dangerous enough that he won't be able to buy a weapon. I mean, I think Hillary Clinton put it succinctly and beautifully when she said, you know, most of us can't carry a bottle of shampoo on an airplane, but someone who's not allowed to fly on an airplane can go buy an AR-15 gun. I mean, I that's crazy.
It makes no sense.
Now, with the bigger terror watch list where there are 800,000 people on it or something like that,
yeah.
I mean, there's some difficulties there, I think, with putting a gun ban. And that would be much harder. But if you're on the no-fly note, if you're on the no-fly list, you know you are, or it's not a secret that you are, and I just think that's a no-brainer.
There was some research that I was reading that the FBI, lack of coordination is a huge problem between all of these, between Homeland Security, FBI, and local officials. It always has been. Every time something like this happens, we talk about it, and still the walls are there. They work in silos, and that is a huge problem. But the idea that you could... the FBI could do a better job of vetting the no-fly list to make sure that they are targeting the right people and then forward that information to federally licensed gun dealers, I think is probably doable.
Right.
You can't vet 800,000 people, but I think 10,000 are on the no-fly list.
And I think of the 800,000, it's a pretty small number who are Americans. I don't know if that matters or not. But the thing about that list is that it's also secret. So, you know, you don't want someone who's under surveillance to go in and buy a gun and have the gun dealer say, oh, it says here I can't sell you a gun. You must be under surveillance, and to tip them off. That's a problem. And, yeah, and I do think there would have to be some sort of appeal process for that as well, you know, that there'd be some due process necessary. So I think the Republicans are onto something there. They just have to figure out how to do it.
Well, the NRA has an obvious position on this, and props to Donald Trump, right? He's going to tell the NRA, no, I think we should actually restrict gun ownership to some of these people.
I think it's funny, interesting that Donald Trump.
Funny, haha. No.
Well, no, it's just,
no.
I'm not
funny,
sure.
How, interesting.
Funny, interesting that. That Donald Trump wants to change this policy, and he's not going to the lawmakers who are responsible for changing the policy. He's going to the money. I mean, that's a pretty, I think, funny, interesting thing, right? How often do you do that? Well, if he believes that the no-fly, no-buy thing should be, or you know, should be in effect, why doesn't he go to Republican senators and say, "Hey, you guys need to do this"? Instead, it's either cynical or it's completely and absolutely realistic. He's going to the people who are funding those senators, right?
The NRA.
Right, because they're going to do whatever the NRA tells them. I just, you know, maybe it's just a bluntness that should be appreciated. I just think it's kind of interesting
he's
doing that.
I think it is, because
that.
I don't think the NRA is going to do his bidding on this. I mean, nobody agrees with Donald Trump on everything, so there'll be a disconnect there, but at least Trump is making his position clear, and it's quite clear.
I hope he succeeds. Absolutely.
Yeah, so you're going to vote for him now, right?
I really hope he succeeds in this.
Isn't it amazing? What was the reaction, Kristen? You go first when you heard about his braggadocious tweet after the Orlando shooting saying, see, I told you so. Thanks for the sort of congratulations. I was right. We need to get tough. Those were his first couple of tweets.
I mean, when I heard about it, I was disgusted. When I actually went back and read the tweets, they just look like everything else he's ever tweeted. So why would you expect like a moment of humility from this person? Then I wasn't offended, because it's just very symbolic of how he operates.
Yeah, shame on you if you're shocked by this, huh?
Sort of. And really, I mean, some of the news coverage was a little overbearing if you actually go back and read his words. I thought he was overtly and repeatedly congratulating himself. He really doesn't do that, but still, it's tasteless. But again, this is who our nominee is, so...
Well, I thought, oh boy, when this happened, I'm not going to look. I don't want to know, but I could just type in Trump tweet, and I know he would have said something, and I resisted it for a day or so. And then somehow or another, I found out what it was, and I thought, wow, he really doesn't disappoint. He's actually capable of turning this into something self-regarding and ugly, and he did, and he did. It was spectacular that way. Let's real quick go to what Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie have sort of been talking about for a while now. You both have interesting columns. When was yours first written, Kristen, about why you are a Republican? Eric wrote why he supports Democrats in Illinois. When did your first piece run? A month ago or so, right?
No, last week. I think it was
last week
or the middle of the week before. And I don't identify myself as a Republican. I just said that I ran away from the Democratic Party of Illinois, just to clarify.
You wrote, in part, the Democratic Supermajority General Assembly adjourned this spring without passing school funding reform, without approving an elected school board for Chicago, without advancing a graduated income tax, without enforcing a higher minimum wage. Democratic voters, punched drunk on ideals, should be questioning their loyalty to Democratic Party leaders. What good are you? It's like you're not even in charge. House Speaker Mike Madigan didn't advance school funding reform in the House. The Senate sent him a bill more than 2 years in the making that would have finally corrected the unfair funding formula. That bill didn't even get a hearing in the House. Not even a hearing. How is the Democratic Party working out for you, education reformers? Eric Zorn wrote, I'm convinced that for all the faults and all of their failings, our state's Democrats are the bulwark against a Republican social and economic agenda that would repeal most of the past half century of progress. Without them, Illinois would become Kansas, a conservative think tank experiment in tax cutting gone. And then he wrote Agley, A-G-L-E-Y. Did he mean awry, or is Agley a word I don't understand?
I don't know. We'll have to ask the legendary columnist.
A-G-L-E-Y.
He's talking to his MP3 player right
he's
now.
He's pounding his dashboard. Or we'll be like North Carolina, he said, an ongoing disaster for those who believe in abortion rights, voting rights, environmental protection, protective taxation, etc. Finally, he wrote, "It's not foolish for those of us who want to live in the 21st century to remain grudgingly loyal to the flawed party that dragged America into the future. The Republicans have left us with little choice."
Agley is an adverb meaning off the right line, awry, or wrong.
Okay.
Yeah. I think he should have gone with awry, but, you know, he's a wordsmith, so I'll give him this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's not here to defend himself, but just give me your thoughts about what Eric Zorn was saying, Kristen.
Well, I mean, he makes a case based on social policy, and I don't disagree with some of what he said. I am pretty socially liberal. I stuck to the facts on fiscal policy and how it hurts the middle class and how the Democratic Party is not delivering on a lot of what the progressives want. And, you know, he tries to make a case that Democrats in charge somehow are taking care of the poor better, schooling kids better, you know, that if Republicans came in charge, we would be against mandating expansions in Medicaid, blah, blah, blah. We can't afford a lot of what he talks about. And I also think he's just kind of blanketing, calling Republicans in general, you know, racist, backwater, whatever. The Republican minority in the state legislature in Illinois is actually pretty moderate. And I just think he's just kind of on the Democratic talking points that there's something to fear if they were to take over. When if you look at 12 years of Democratic control, I think it's been absolutely disastrous for the very people that Eric Zorn wants to protect.
Hmm. You know, I read the two pieces and came away with, we've got to get Mike Madigan out of there. I think people should be able to vote for representatives that aren't in their district. You know, if you live downstate or upstate, you should be able to vote in Mike Madigan's district and actually vote him out. How about that for a plan?
Or make
with me on that.
No one, but make Speaker a statewide office. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, kind of like that, Steve.
How about you just recognize that if you are, maybe we're moving in this direction. I like my local Democratic lawmaker, but this person is going to create a supermajority for Mike Madigan, and I'm just not going to do it this year. That's what it's going to take. Are voters going to go down that path?
So vote against the party
it.
You always do, just vote to send that message.
Stop complaining about the speakership of Mike Madigan if you're going to go in the voting booth and keep sending Democrats down who elect him speaker.
It's kind of what Republicans are going to have to do on the general election at the national level, isn't it? And you know what you wrote about school funding? So there is a bill that said that property taxes won't determine the funding for local schools. And that doesn't go anywhere? Is that what you're saying?
It rejiggered the formula so that lower property wealthy schools would get more state aid.
Yeah.
And it took from some of the wealthier districts. It basically shoved all of the money through a formula, whereas now about half of the money goes to the formula and half of it goes through grants. So it was, in my opinion, a very honest, good bill proposed by a Democratic senator who's been working on it for a couple of years. They all sat in the House chamber in a committee meeting waiting for a hearing even on this. It was scheduled one of the last days of session. They sat there for hours and hours waiting for it to get called. It never even got called for a hearing in the executive committee, which Madigan oversees.
There is someone to vote for or to support in this. And, you know, there's the movement again to get a call to change the way we draw legislative maps on the ballot in November.
Yeah.
And they've got the signatures that was certified this week. They're going to have to win in court first. But, I mean, and that's probably wouldn't have an impact for years to come. But I just think in so many areas of this country, that would go a long way toward easing some of our problems.
Would you guys take children to the Grand Floridian for a vacation in Orlando?
Tomorrow. Absolutely.
Okay.
I don't know how it is you've got a place where alligators, and this isn't and is like the zoo and the gorilla. I don't know how it is that you've got kids standing in a foot of water and an alligator can snatch them. And, well, that's the way it is here in Orlando. I don't understand that.
Have we gotten a good explanation to, because I've read that the boy was on the shoreline, that he was on the sand, that he was in the water. Not that any of, you know, we're kind of splicing and dicing here, but did the alligator actually come all the way out of the water? Because
I thought I heard the sheriff say they were in about a foot of water.
Okay.
That's what I read too. Yeah. So the boy is not swimming, and there was no sign there that said, beware, alligators may take your children down. The boy was standing in a foot of water, And it was in the evening, and maybe that's when they're more aggressive or they feed, but the kid was just standing there. He or his parents weren't really doing anything wrong. That could have been any of us.
Yeah.
And shoom, like that. Somebody told me, they said, you watch, this is going to be a very expensive wrongful death for Disney World, because you just can't have that. That's on them.
Isn't it crazy that they've had this set up and they do at other resorts as well? And is that just part of the culture of Florida, which is very much gators are everywhere?
Right.
I mean, you drive
there's
down
1.25 million. I looked it up. They estimate 1.25 million alligators in Florida.
When I go to Florida, that's all I do. Every time I see a body of water, I'm not kidding you.
I do too.
I love looking for alligators. And I remember being on that ferry with the kids going to Disney World over, I think it's that body of water, right? Looking at that water thinking, I wonder, what do you think? You see any? I mean, you just do. And that doesn't mean that the parents were negligent for letting it happen.
Nope.
But it does happen. I shouldn't say it does happen, because it almost never, ever, ever happens. Look at all the kids who've gone through Disney World, who've been at that resort. It's an extremely rare event. And sometimes those things just happen. Yeah. I mean, we're so quick to try to blame someone or to find fault with someone. It was a terrible thing. And sometimes terrible things just happen.
I'm with you, Steve.
One last thing. Did you guys watch the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Golden State Warriors game?
I didn't, but I'm leaving. Here's your moment to talk about this game, because I did not, but I read about it.
It's going to be a monologue, I'm afraid.
No, it's
not.
Go ahead. But here's the point.
No, I didn't see it either, John. That's what I meant.
Well, people are comparing the Bulls, right, to the Golden State Warriors, the 2-3s for the Bulls. And I just want to say Michael Jordan would never have let his team implode like the Warriors did in Game 6. They acted immature, and they acted like they didn't belong there. And you just can't imagine Jordan throwing his mouthpiece into the stands and storming off and being ejected from Game 6. I just thought, wow, the Bulls are better. The Bulls always will be better, because they never collapsed like that. So that was my thing. And then you guys go, yeah, John, I really feel this, or blah, 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 blah.
I don't think Jordan would go back to the fans and apologize during the game either, the way Steph Curry did.
Oh, wait a minute. Steph went back and apologized to the fans?
To whoever got hit with his whipped mouth guard? Yeah.
I think that's a real keepsake there. That's that's now worth $82,000 on eBay, probably.
And, you know, and then his wife tweeted out that it was all fixed for the networks.
Oh, my God, yeah. I thought about Tom Brady's wife, too. Remember when she said, you don't know how hard it is for my husband. He can't catch the ball, too. And then she takes it off, and I thought, no, it actually never comes down. You know, you may delete that tweet, right, but that was out, and it will be permanently on your record. Okay, let's do our recommendations. We close our podcast with something that we think you might enjoy seeing, watching, reading, listening to, or consuming. Steve, do you want to start? Anything that you're recommending this week?
I'm leading a group of WGN listeners to Prague and Vienna at the end of the month. So I put out on Facebook suggestions for books set in Prague or Vienna to start, you know, reading up. And I'd forgotten that The Unbearable Lightness of Being was set in Prague in 1968. So I'm going to read that. That's my recommendation, even though I haven't picked it up myself.
Fair enough. How about you, Kristen? What do you like this week?
Well, I'm feeling guilty that Eric was not here to defend himself on his column, so I'm going to skip my recommendation for In Another Life, which is a book I'm reading, and say read Eric Zorn's column today on why he's sticking with the Democratic Party.
I'm just going to recommend that you Google on YouTube America's Got Talent. I find myself getting drawn into these performances. I don't watch the whole show, but the individual performances always get reposted. And there is a guy named Salvatore Vincenetti or something like that. And he's from Long Island, and he delivers pizza for his cousin, okay? He wears gold chains. He's kind of square. And if this is an image you have in your mind, this is that guy. He came up and he did My Way by Frank Sinatra and just killed it. It's so much fun to watch. And so there's, if you want something that's not painful to watch or argumentative, go watch some of the videos from America's Got Talent. They're having a good season. And that is this episode of The Mincing Rascals. I'm John Williams. Thank you to our producer, Kristen Decker. Thank you, Bob Ferguson, our engineer. We'll drop another podcast on you, including one Eric Zorn, next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNplus.com. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus podcast network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 1:30 to 2 p.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.